Now we continue with our conversation with Tim Madden. Have you attempted to debate or propose this at the academic level to the professors of economics throughout Canada or any other comparable group such that this message could be understood, amplified, and agreed upon at that level, sort of from the top down or from the academic corner in?
The short answer is no, not directly. I did it one time. But unfortunately, you've got a whole academic superstructure in there. They all have a vested interest in this. And the simple answer is they can't stop because they've got their entire lives and intellectual capacity invested in this. They never stop to look at an actual mortgage and say, wait a minute, that isn't true. How is it that the economists can't seem to explain where this $1.2 trillion has come from over the last 20 years? Well, the government didn't print it, so how is it being created? And they don't say this. There's a huge body of literature that's been written about this since the mid-60s on the psychological effects of the economics profession being in a trap that they can't stop supporting this system because to do so would be to admit to yourself that you've wasted your life on a shell game. Paul Barron and Paul Sweezy, they're a couple of professors of Harvard and Stanford, respectively. They wrote a book in 1965 that was on this theme. This is so simple and so easy. How can they possibly be supporting such a system and trying to explain it when there's not an iota of academic credibility to it? And the short answer is, you're a professor, PhD, you've spent 12 years studying curves and mathematics, and you haven't bothered to check your basic premise. The short answer again is it's just too intellectually embarrassing for these people to admit that they're wrong. And so they throw up the walls and they pretend that you don't know what you're talking about. And if you look, there's a book by the name of, I think it's Paul Gross out of Princeton University in 1977. It's called Friendly Fascism. And he says, if we don't take the bull by the horns very shortly, you are going to see the corporations take over the entirety of society and they will make their own logic. And as we've seen, the business schools have been taken over and are now funded by those corporations and they do consulting work. And if you want your grants and your research money, you had better come up with the solution that suits the person who's writing the checks. It's insidious. It really is. We've seen the same in the pharmaceutical industries. They do studies, but the professors know intuitively, I can't go there. I'm going to construct my study to sort of limit the possibilities as to what I can conclude. And everything sort of just meshes seamlessly until somebody says, oh, wait a minute, the emperor has no clothes. And that's where we're at now.
So I want to raise a last question, which is not really an economics question. It's more a psychological question about exactly this point you've just mentioned. There is built into the human brain a certain self-preservation program or survival program. When threatened, do A. When threatened more, do A plus B. What happens when it becomes evident to the organism that if they continue using the old strategies, A plus B, to handle a perceived threat, if they continue doing that, then in fact, they're guaranteeing their own demise because if this system continues much longer, everything will fall apart. For example, if countries continue to threaten each other with nuclear warfare and it goes further and further until finally there is nuclear warfare, all countries lose. So at that point, that very survival program becomes self-reflective. It looks like if I continue down this path, I become a threat to myself. Whereas prior to that, it seemed like if I continue down this path, at least I guarantee that I survive. Other people might suffer, but I'm going to survive. So the academics that you just talked about were protecting themselves because it was the safest thing for them to do. But now you're talking about world economy or the economy of Canada, and you gave the image of the bus with no driver. So it's not a question of taking control from the driver. It's a question of getting in there and actually driving the bus because it's going on its own. Everybody's on it. And if it continues to roll down the road too much longer, the road may curve and the bus will go over the precipice. So at that point, everyone's survival program shifts and it becomes necessary for even the lawyers, even the bankers, even the university economists to suddenly change their strategy and join the group that's trying to keep the bus from going over the cliff. Are we getting close to that point? And is that psychological scenario I just covered, does that relate in your mind to where we are?
Absolutely. You're describing what psychologists call fight or flee syndrome. That is, when you're confronted with a crisis, you have the overwhelming urge to either stand and fight or run and hide. And so it's called the fight or flee syndrome. Now, what has been happening is that psychologically, you deny the reality of the crisis you are facing by the people at the top who are benefiting from the situation telling you that the only alternative is chaos. Anarchy started as a political movement in the late 1800s. It is, in fact, the ultimate form of personal responsibility. Everybody is responsible for their own actions, and the penalty is banishment. If you can't control your own self, then you're out of the group. We don't want to have you as part of our collective. And that scared the powers that be so much that they immediately reassigned the meaning of the word to mean chaos. And we have reached the point now where we have the collective capacity to kill ourselves and this planet over and over and over again. We have to make a decision. Either we are going to recognize that we have been sold a bill of goods, and we are going to take the initiative to get back what is ours and to take some mode of control over this situation, or we're simply going to allow the other side to continue on this road to madness and just basically blow us all up, be it financially, literally, or psychologically, or what have you, you know?
And then as it reaches the point of where people start in large numbers to realize this, isn't it also probable that little by little, the ranks of the so-called controlling group, the bankers, the lawyers, will start to turn around and join the reform movement?
Oh, absolutely. Like, for instance, picture the legal profession in Canada. There's something like 80,000 lawyers. 10,000 of them are pure tax lawyers. But there's approximately 80,000 lawyers in Canada. But there's only the top 10% are the ones that are really benefiting from this. And I saw this with a lot of my friends in Edmonton. Like, literally, the cliche for me is true that some of my best friends are lawyers. And you watch them, you know, over the years as they grow up. You spend 4 years in university. Then you spend another 3 years in law school. Then you do your articling. Then by the time you get a firm established or you go in with an established firm already, you're 35 years old and you've got a lifetime invested in this thing. And you go before a judge and you look at him sideways and you are out of it. You're disbarred and you have to go back to square one. You've got 10 years to write off. And that is an incredible social control mechanism. As I said before, that was why it was so empowering for me to stand before that three-judge tribunal. They were really more scared of me than I was of them because they didn't have that to take away from me and they weren't used to dealing with people who...
You couldn't be disbarred because you weren't a lawyer.
I'm not a lawyer, so they can't take that away from me. They looked at each other like, how do we control this guy? You know, he's here explaining the law to us and he's right. You know, we can't threaten him with disbarment. The essential point is that there is a pyramid within a pyramid among the legal profession. And these people, the lawyers and the junior lawyers, the 80% that are not on the major gravy train yet, they just have to realize and look and say, look, this system is unraveling so fast, I'm never going to make it to that position. And therefore, it is to my advantage to help an organized wind down, a soft landing, as it were, rather than risk, you know, the wrath of the majority. Because people all over Canada are suddenly waking up and going, holy smoke, not only am I not a bum, I've been cheated out of my equity from day one, and this system has been lying to me, cheating, whatever it has to keep me from asserting my right as a sovereign individual, as a citizen of this country, and as the productive engine of this country.
Let's hope that the day comes soon when the majority of new lawyers, new bankers, new economists looks ahead and sees at the end of the gravy train that there's no more gravy there. It's a bowl of bad-tasting dishwater. And that the real gravy is in turning around and coming back into balance and appropriate action rather than maintaining this elite system, which is actually to no one's advantage in the end.
Exactly. As far as the lawyers go, you've got to give them an alternative. You really do. Give them an alternative and say, look, let's give everybody 5 years to wind down. You got 5 years to find a new profession. Whatever you've made over the last 5 years, we will continue to pay you as a salary. And just, you know, take up basket weaving if you want to, you know, or anything you want. You're just not going to be in the business of managing slaves anymore. It's basically what it comes down to.